Okay, so good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is Thursday, January 26th. And we just got to finish up a couple of things in chapter one and then move on to chapter two, which is chemistry. But you just got an announcement from your SI leader. Here is a sign-in sheet. Not everybody is on this, but anybody who registered last night, but not today. So make sure you sign your name right here. This is your receipt that you were in class. And if by chance, for some reason, I drop you for being absent, you can say, "Oh, why do you think I'm absent? Because I signed in here. Oh, and I signed in that date and that date and that date." Right? So here is your receipt that you're in class. Every time, make sure you sign it. Even if you come in late, I might let you sign it. But make sure that you do sign it, because if you don't sign it, I can't tell if you're here or not. And if it's not signed, then guess what? By definition, you're absent. Right? So make sure you sign the sign-in sheet every time. Okay, let's pass that around. Okay, does anybody need a welcome letter? The instructions on how to log into Blackboard. Some people that just recently added the class. I know some people this morning got add codes. Make sure you have a welcome letter. So nobody in here needs a welcome letter. I got a couple of copies. And also, syllabus. I know there's various ways you can find the syllabus online, but if you want a hard copy, I've got a hard copy. Raise your hand if you want a hard copy. Oh, great. Okay. So pass this one back that way. Pass this one back kind of that way and that way. Okay. There's two more over here. Yeah, just raise your hand until it filters back to you. And pass that just straight back. Pass this one straight back. Like this. As a matter of fact, keep passing that one back. Here's another one. Oh, no, that's a welcome letter. Never mind. Those are all welcome letters. Forget it. Here are the syllabuses. Okay, who still needs one here? Okay. Yeah, we got plenty. Pass one over to the other side right there. Okay, it gets there. And then one, two, three, four. Okay, and then there's one extra one. Just keep passing back. So I think there's enough for this row right here. All right, so as these are kind of filtering around, nice random walk back to you. I think there should be one coming up. Oh, these are anatomy? Oh. Okay. Well, you've taken anatomy already. I tell you what, drop them off on the table on the way out of class. Sorry about that. Okay. And then follow me up to my office, and I'll give you the syllabus for physiology. Okay. All right, well, I got the welcome letter for 241. All right, so does anybody have any questions? Anybody have any questions? All right, listen up, you guys. Listen up, you guys. So now don't forget, this week, you got to absolutely log into Blackboard. If that's a problem, see me right after class, and we'll fix it. I can fix it by email pretty easily over the weekend if you're having a problem, because you have some deadlines coming up for your weekly assignments. All right, so don't miss those. So you got to make sure you can log into Blackboard. I'm not going to demonstrate that today. All right, so we were talking about homeostasis last time. Here is a very important figure. This is an exam figure. Many of you should have it memorized by now, except maybe some students that are going to add the 1:00 lab today. So make sure you draw this out on a blank piece of paper and understand everything about it. Okay, so what does a response loop always begin with? A stimulus. And what does it always end with? A response. And there can be two kinds of feedback, right? So here is the response will produce feedback, right? And it can either add to the stimulus or subtract from it. What do we call it when it subtracts from the stimulus? Negative feedback. Is that a bad thing? No, that's a good thing, right? Because if negative feedback is employed, that will lead to a healthy state, a disease-free state. It will take that stimulus and force it back toward the set point, right? And then that physiologic parameter will stop its variation away from the set point, and then it will go to the set point, and that will maintain life. Okay, I got to find my cursor. Where's my cursor? It disappears. It's because I didn't tell it to stay around. I don't know what mouse button it requires to do that. Ah, pointer options. Arrow options visible. Okay, really good. Now to go back. Great. Okay, so these are all the steps and the anatomy that's involved with the response loop, right? So remember, it always starts with the stimulus. Modify the figures that are in your textbook because usually they just kind of leave off the stimulus and response. And what kind of structure produces the response? It is what? The effector. And since you've had anatomy already, you should be able to group some classes of effectors in your mind. There are autonomic effectors and somatic effectors. What's the list of autonomic effectors? What can produce a response in your body that's part of the autonomic system? You have, what are some things that you can't control? Your heart. All right, so a heart is an effector. And it changes rate, changes force of contraction. What's another kind of muscle that is autonomic? Smooth muscle, right? So cardiac muscle, smooth muscle. Those are autonomic effectors. And then there's one other kind of autonomic effector. A gland, right? So autonomic effectors would be glands, cardiac muscle, smooth muscle. And what is the only kind of somatic effector? Skeletal muscle. And guess what? Skeletal muscle is the only thing that you have control of in your whole body. So that's just revisiting some anatomy. The integration center right here, some things are left off this slide, but what does the integration center do? It analyzes the input, right? It analyzes the stimulus right here, and it compares the stimulus to what? It compares something. In the analysis process, it compares it to the set point, so the integration center has a set point, and then it makes a decision on what to do. Sends that decision, right? If the stimulus is different than the set point, right, it sends some kind of corrective action out through this efferent pathway to an effector, right, so that this response subtracts from the stimulus if it's a nice negative feedback loop. That does not mean that all positive feedback loops are unhealthy for you. There are some, and we're going to learn maybe about five important positive feedback mechanisms, right, that maintain homeostasis or a normal state. But most are negative feedback loops. And that's the job of medicine, okay, when you're sick, to try to nudge your body back to where these negative feedback loops are automatically, right, become effective and then bring you back into a healthy condition. Okay, so make sure you can draw this diagram out. And then through the rest of the class, make sure that you think of feedback loops just according to that diagram right there. And in lab, we present you with some more examples. As a matter of fact, in here, we're going to present you with some more examples. All right, so remember, negative feedback is when the response subtracts from the stimulus that produces a healthy state that maintains homeostasis. Positive feedback, on the other hand, adds to the stimulus and it drives that system farther and farther away from the set point. So for instance, if something raises your body temperature, positive feedback would cause your temperature to increase further, right? Which then would cause your temperature to increase further, right? Become higher and higher and higher, and you become hyperthermic, and eventually you just turn into this ball of flame and disappear in a puff of smoke, right? And that would not be a healthy, disease-free state. Okay. Well, that doesn't really happen, but that's just kind of fun to think about. Spontaneous combustion of a person. That doesn't really happen. But if your temperature does get very high, of course, that is a lethal state, hyperthermia. Okay. All right, homeostasis in terms of regulatory mechanisms, we looked at some short-range mechanisms and some long-range reflexes and some signaling compounds that are associated with them, like neurotransmitters. As a matter of fact, you might want to write down someplace in your notes what your favorite neurotransmitter is. Hormones, write down what your favorite hormone is. So think of at least one example of some of those things. All right, but let's analyze homeostasis and regulatory loops in a different way. Okay, some are intrinsic, some are extrinsic. And an intrinsic control is built right into the organ that's being regulated. So it's not a reflex at all, so it's not even a short-range reflex. A really good example of that will be the Frank Starling Law of the Heart. And when we get into the cardiovascular chapter, we'll really look at this law right here. But basically what the Frank Starling Law says is that when you have a lot of return of blood to the heart, and the heart starts to fill up with blood, Under normal circumstances, what do you think? As the heart is presented more blood to pump, should it get weaker or should it get stronger when it's given more blood to pump? And I heard a lot of the correct answers, okay? And the heart does get stronger. It contracts with more force just because it gets stretched out. And so the heart is regulating its own activity based on the kind of load conditions that is presented to it. So that's the Frank Starling Law. Unfortunately, that means, though, when blood doesn't go back to the heart, it gets weaker. Now, that's not a really good circumstance. Maybe you're in a car accident and you start to lose a lot of blood by hemorrhage because you lacerate a blood vessel, so you don't have a lot of blood going back to the heart. So unfortunately, then what happens to that person? Since the blood is kind of running out on the pavement, doesn't go back to the heart starts to shrink down. The Frank Starling Law says that the heart is going to get weaker. So even though it might have some blood to pump, it's going to pump very little bit of that blood, okay? So then we have to take some countermeasures right away to boost that cardiac function up. We'll talk about that when we get to the cardiovascular chapter. But that would be a pathological condition. Under normal conditions, the Frank Starling Law is very beneficial to people. It keeps us nice and healthy. Okay, next. Okay. I don't know, did we talk about this slide last time? No, I'm not quite sure we did. Okay, extrinsic requires some anatomy, some sensors that are not located in the organ that is being regulated. So it's going to require some receptors in a different part of the body, and it might require some nerves to carry signals from one part of your body to another, or hormones to go from one part of your body to another part. It's just not located in one organ. So here is the normal range of body temperature to maintain homeostasis. Your body temperature isn't exactly at 37 degrees Celsius, and you know that, right? Because as soon as you start walking around or exercising, what do you notice about your body? Okay. Oh, did you have a thermometer with you to measure that or what? How do you know you're getting hot? Oh, yeah, because you start sweating right away. So that's a nice indication that your body temperature is increasing, right? So that's some de facto proof that your body temperature does increase when you start to exercise, because you don't start sweating unless your body temperature does go up, right? So that's an important point, because homeostasis doesn't mean that your body temperature is absolutely constant, right? To be normal, your body temperature can go down and go up, but it doesn't go beyond this normal range of values that's suitable to support life. All right, and then maybe sometime in your life you were really, really cold. How did you know you were really, really cold? Because you start shivering or shaking, right? Maybe you measured your body temperature, maybe you didn't, but at least you noticed that you were shivering, right? So that, again, that's kind of proof that your body temperature is not absolutely constant. All right, so extrinsic control in this particular case, maybe of some core part of your body. There are thermoreceptors in the brain that monitor your body temperature, and as your body temperature decreases, then those temperature receptors send information to the brain that causes shivering and skeletal muscle, and that metabolic activity increases the heat, produces heat in your body, so then you start to retain heat that brings your body temperature back up. Okay, so the stimulus was a decrease in temperature, and what was the response? An increase. Okay, and what can you tell me about the stimulus compared to the response right here? Do they add together or subtract from each other in this particular case? It subtracts from each other. So what kind of feedback mechanism is operating under these circumstances right here? That's a nice negative feedback mechanism. So then you're shivering, and then your body temperature goes too high, and there are temperature receptors in the brain that notice that, send signals to your skin, which is long range, that's extrinsic, all right, that then cause you to sweat. And so here is the stimulus, an increase in body temperature. Here is the response, a decrease. How do they relate to each other mathematically? Do they add or subtract? They subtract to each other. So again, here is nice negative feedback on this descending limb of this temperature curve right here. And so all day long, your body temperature is going up and down, but it's within this normal range to support life. So whenever you see a physiologic parameter that starts to decrease, but then it goes back toward the set point, you should automatically just be able to analyze that curve and say, what kind of feedback is happening, positive or negative? It's going to be negative, right? If it starts to decrease and then it decreases more and more and more and more, what kind of feedback is taking place? Positive feedback, right? So that's going to drive you farther and farther away from the set point and into a disease state, which of course can be fatal. Okay, so whenever you see this variation above and below the set point, you should just know that that is nice negative feedback. Just with a really quick look at that graph, you can tell. All right, so here we have a graph. We have glucose concentration in the blood, I won't tell you the units right here, versus time, and then all of a sudden, so it's pretty constant right here. It's varying just a little bit, but this is another example of extrinsic control. We're going to inject some organism with insulin, and then what happens with insulin, glucose in the blood is allowed to leave the blood and go into cells. Cells start to take up glucose when insulin is present. And if glucose is leaving the blood to go in cells, what happens to the blood glucose concentration? It goes down. So here we see a dip in blood glucose concentration here as a result of this insulin injection. All right. But now what happens to blood glucose concentration? It goes back toward the set point. So what kind of feedback mechanism is working in this example right here? It's a nice negative feedback mechanism, right? Because after this perturbation, that blood glucose concentration goes back to the set point. If, however, it started to decrease and then continued to decrease, what kind of feedback mechanism would be working? Positive. All right, so which kind of feedback mechanism maintains a nice healthy state right here? A nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, and we're going to look and see how this blood glucose does recover, okay, in later parts of the class. It's going to require the liver to do that. All right, so this is an example of extrinsic mechanism because the organ that we're looking at right here is blood, and the organ that helps maintain homeostasis is the liver. So it just doesn't happen in the blood. It needs some other kind of control mechanisms. And there is another hormone that is involved with this negative feedback loop over here. So we're really interested in insulin. We talk about it all the time clinically, but there's another hormone that is antagonistic to insulin. Does anybody know what that hormone is? And we hardly talk about it clinically because we usually talk about insulin. It's antagonistic to insulin. So if insulin decreases blood glucose, the antagonistic hormone will increase it. Okay, and the name of that hormone is called glucagon. Glucagon comes from the pancreas just like insulin does, okay, but it works the other way. Okay, so that's what I want you to see with that slide. All right, some regulatory mechanisms that are positive feedback but are normal, okay. Remember that a positive feedback mechanism will amplify a response, a change from a set point. All right, and usually these things are very rapid, and that's when it can be employed in your body in a normal circumstance. It's involved in producing blood clots. Some positive feedback mechanisms are important for forming blood clots, and that process is called coagulation of blood. There are other processes we'll talk about in the blood. But for instance, do you think that's a really good idea to have a fast process to coagulate blood? Yeah, because if you cut your arm and maybe you lacerate a blood vessel, maybe a big blood vessel, blood comes squirting out. Okay, can you afford to sit around for a week or two for that blood vessel to heal over or for that blood to coagulate? No, it should happen very fast, right? And so there's a positive feedback mechanism that makes sure that that happens. And people that are missing that positive feedback mechanism have reduced clotting function, and they can bleed to death, as in the case of a condition called hemophilia, right? They're missing that positive feedback loop in there. In females, it's used to create a surge in a hormone called luteinizing hormone. And when luteinizing hormone skyrockets, that causes ovulation. Okay, and then as soon as the follicle ovulates, then that positive feedback loop is disturbed, and then negative feedback then starts to control the reproductive cycle in the female. But for a short period of time, there's a positive feedback loop that causes ovulation. Positive feedback between the uterus, right, and oxytocin secretion during labor. It's the fetus that really controls when it wants to be born, not the mom, but there is a communication between the mom and the fetus via some stress hormones and oxytocin. Oxytocin is secreted by the mom, and it causes the uterus to contract, and that Do you think that causes stress on the fetus, or does that relieve the fetus of stress when the uterus contracts? That stresses, right? Because a little fetus is in there, is used to playing soccer and running around, right, during gestation. And all of a sudden now that uterus becomes really, really small and contracted, and the fetus goes, oh, what's going on here? Something is really bad. And guess what? I'm too big to stay in here any longer. And it secretes stress hormones, which then causes an increase in oxytocin, which causes what? More stress hormones from the fetus, which causes more oxytocin from the mom. And then that can't go on forever because the whole universe would be filled up with stress hormones and oxytocin. But what happens? Then you have parturition, right? And then things go back to nice negative feedback. Okay, so that's parturition. And also some electrical events inside the cell called depolarization use positive feedback to make these electrical events happen very rapidly as well. And we're going to get to talking about action potentials pretty soon in the nervous chapter. So maybe memorize these four things. All right, so let's talk about some things that we've defined and look at a feedback loop. So here we have a person lying down, and this is a normal person, just like all of us in here, and we're lying down, and the blood pressure in this person's head is exactly as the blood pressure in his big toe right here, because it's all at the same level. Okay? So if we were to put some books, for instance, right on this guy's nose right here, what would happen to his nose? It would get squished because the books are pressing down on his nose, right? So when you put things on top of each other, they press down on each other, but since this guy is lying flat down, the pressure in his body is exactly the same. All right, but then he hears his alarm and he says, oh, time for physiology lab or anatomy lab. Let's get going. So he jumps up. Okay, so he jumps up, and now there's high pressure down here in his toe, and what kind of pressure is up here in the head? Really low pressure, because there's nothing standing on top of it anymore, and without that blood pressure, all right, blood won't go up to the brain, and you might get dizzy if that were to happen, right? You might even pass out, all right? So blood pressure falls when you change body position, from even a sitting position that you're in right now, but certainly when you're in a lying position right here. Blood pressure falls, but there are pressure resensors in the neck and around the heart specifically, and then it will send that blood pressure. That's the stimulus, right? A decrease in blood pressure. So I've modified this slide that's in your book to make it correspond to that nice diagram that you have to memorize. All right, so that's the stimulus. The sensor are the baroreceptors. A baroreceptor measures pressure. Like a barometer is a pressure meter. We have those inside our body. These send that information via afferent neurons to the cardioregulatory center in the medulla oblongata, which is the integration center. What does the integration center have? It has what the normal blood pressure should be, right? And if there's a difference, then it decides what to do. It says, we better bring the blood pressure back up in this person or they're going to pass out. Just because they're standing up. Does that ever happen? Yeah, that's called orthostatic hypotension, right? If somebody's blood pressure is so low or if this mechanism isn't working, then people can pass out when they stand up, which is not a really good thing. Why is that? Oh, because then you're going to fall, right? And if it's right here in class, your head is going to bounce off the tabletop first, and it's going to bounce off the chair, and it's going to bounce off the floor, and that's really bad when that happens, right? So you should recover blood pressure. Medulla oblongata then sends signals out the efferent fibers. And this slide doesn't contain all the possible effectors, but here's an effector, right? Here's an autonomic effector. It means you don't have to do this. This happens automatically in your body. Right? To increase blood pressure, what do you think the heart should do? Should the heart rate increase or decrease? It should increase. What about force of contraction? What would help a decrease in blood pressure? A stronger heart rate. So not only faster, but also stronger, two things that will increase the blood pressure in this person. And so here's the response. What's the response compared to the stimulus? Does it add or subtract from it? It subtracts, so here is a nice negative feedback mechanism, okay, that maintains homeostasis in this person so his head doesn't bounce off all those objects when he passes out. Okay, here is another feedback loop. All right, so let me go back to this slide. Is this extrinsic or intrinsic? Extrinsic, because it requires a lot of machinery and structures throughout the whole body, right? The baroreceptors and the brain and the heart, right? So that's extrinsic regulation. Okay, let's look at that blood glucose once again. Here we have somebody eating. When somebody's eating, we say they are in the fed state, F-E-D, fed. And when you're eating, you have food going through your digestive tract, and then glucose is going to be absorbed into the body when that happens, when you're in a fed state. So then blood glucose concentration increases when you're in a fed state because you're absorbing glucose from those nutrients that you ate. The pancreas, right, then has glucose receptors and says, your blood glucose is increasing above the set point. We're going to secrete a hormone into the blood, which is insulin. And insulin is the passport that allows glucose to be taken up by cells. Without insulin, under most circumstances, glucose cannot be taken up by a cell. And if a cell can't get glucose, it's going to starve to death. Okay, that's the really bad thing about diabetes mellitus. For instance, if somebody isn't producing insulin on them by themselves, those cells in their body are starving to death. But if this is a normal person, all the cells in your body say, insulin is going up. We better let glucose into our cells. So glucose then gets taken up by cells. What happens to blood glucose then when it leaves the blood? Glucose then decreases. So then we have a decreased blood glucose concentration in the blood as a result of this insulin. So that's the response. What was the initial stimulus? Increased blood glucose. So what's the relationship between the glucose here? Does it add together or subtract? That subtracts. So that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. So on a graph, you would see an increase in blood glucose and then a decrease back toward the set point. So if you see an upslope and a downslope, what kind of feedback mechanism would that be? That'd be negative, but if it continued to go up and up and up and up, that would be positive feedback. Okay. As opposed to being in a fed state, some people at some time during the day are in a fasted state. Okay. When is your favorite time to fast? At night when I'm sleeping. That's my favorite time to fast. Otherwise, I usually don't like to fast very much. Okay. Okay. So when you're fasting, you don't have any nutrients in your digestive tract. And so therefore, glucose is not being absorbed into your body. So blood glucose will have a tendency to decrease when you're fasting. All right. And again, that blood or that glucose goes to the pancreas. As a matter of fact, the islets of Langerhans right here says, blood glucose is decreasing. But a bunch of different parts of your body need glucose to stay alive, to make ATP, like your brain, for instance. And so the pancreas says, blood glucose is decreasing. We can do two things to counteract that. Since insulin will cause a further decrease in blood glucose, like we saw in this first example right here, the pancreas says, we're going to stop secreting insulin. That will help. All right, but then it secretes another hormone that we just mentioned, which is glucagon, and then glucagon goes to the liver where you store a lot of glucose day in and day out, and it tells the liver to release that glucose into the blood. And glucose is stored in the liver in a form called glycogen. We're going to use that term a lot. Glycogen is just a fancy storage form for glucose. So millions of little units of glucose can be stored in the liver in the form of glycogen. Okay? And so glycogen is a form of starch that we find in animals. Plants store glucose in exactly what I just mentioned, in the form of starch. So starch and glycogen are very, very similar kinds of molecules. We'll talk about maybe why it's a little bit different from plant starch in a little bit. All right, so glucagon causes the liver to secrete glucose into the blood. All right, so decreasing insulin causes decreased cellular uptake of glucose, right? Because insulin is that passport that allows glucose to enter the cells. When that passport goes away, you can't enter the country. Same thing for glucose. So cellular uptake of glucose decreases or stops, and because of glucagon, glucose is secreted into the blood by the liver. So the overall effect of these two things is an increase in blood glucose. How does that relate to the initial stimulus right here? Add or subtract from? It subtracts from, so here's a nice negative feedback mechanism. And what does a negative feedback mechanism usually promote in the body? It's not on this slide, but you should know it. That is homeostasis, right? Okay. So here are two pretty good examples of that. All right. So when you see this right here, is blood glucose concentration constant? It's going up, it's going down. What about the activity of the pancreas? Is it absolutely constant? No, it's secreting insulin. Sometimes it's slowing the secretion of insulin down, and then it starts to secrete glucagon. So the pancreas is not absolutely constant, right? But these things never vary very far from the normal set point. It maintains glucose in a normal range that's suitable to support life. So don't forget, homeostasis doesn't mean everything is absolutely constant. It means everything is changing in your body all the time, so that nothing changes by a big amount, right? And if nothing changes by a big amount, then you're healthy. If something changes by a big amount, that could be fatal, all right? Or at least put you into a disease state. So homeostasis means what? Everything is dancing around each other. Have you ever seen a Star Trek episode? Ever seen a Star Trek episode? Yeah, there's still some reruns on the TV, right? Who is the doctor on the original Star Trek? Spock was a science officer. He was pretty cool, but he was science. But who is the clinician? That was, the Irishman was the engineer that kept the engines running. Yeah, Bones. I forget what his name is, but everybody just called him Bones. Okay. Well, anyway, when somebody got sick, they put him in sick bay, right, and lie him down on a table. And so here's somebody with his head on the table. And what was right above his head? There was a monitor. Okay, there's a display monitor, and it was measuring, okay, his heart rate and his blood pressure and all kinds of physiologic parameters, and it had arrows. And if you can remember, if you go back and watch a Star Trek episode, what were those arrows doing? Were they just sitting on the screen? They were all bouncing around. And if the patient was getting healthier, how would these arrows bounce around? Within a nice normal range, right? And as soon as a patient died, which happened often, what happened to those arrows? They stopped bouncing around and, right, they went down to the bottom and they just stayed there, right? So homeostasis means what? Physiologic parameters are dancing around each other, compensating for other changes that are taking place in your body. So go back, and that's an assignment for you over the weekend. Watch a Star Trek episode. All right, and then what did Bones say to Captain, who's the captain? Kirk, Captain Kirk, yeah, Captain Kirk. All right, all the arrows go to the bottom. And so what was the famous line from Bones to the captain most of the time? He's dead, Jim. Okay, he would say that repeatedly during the test, right? So if everything is stationary, that's not a good sign. Oh, that's the last slide for this chapter. Okay, so read your book on scientific method and response loop, but don't forget this illustration right here. It's not in your book, but this is really important because it breaks down feedback mechanisms, right? Positive and negative feedback. Okay. All right, so we got to go to another slide presentation, but I need to put this one away first. Who knows how to put this one away? Home, is there a quit button in home? Oh, that's why. Maybe in home. Okay, yes. Escape got me out of the slideshow mode. Oh, if it makes it smaller, that's good, because then I can find the... I still can't... Because the X button is right here somewhere. Ah, good. Got it. Okay. All right, so now I'm going to show this in just a single side. I'm going to show it in this mode for Chapter 2. All right, so Chapter 2 is chemistry. And do you guys love chemistry? You got to say yes, right? Because that's fundamental to physiology. So even if you haven't studied chemistry, okay, we're going to teach a little bit of chemistry in here so that physiology makes some sense. All right, so let's start talking about some chemistry. Good. All right, so that's the place where I'm going to show the PowerPoints. And then this thing I want to slide this thing over here. Okay, you don't have to look at this right at the moment, but So we're going to be concentrating on these slides right here. Okay, now how did I do that before? How did I right click? Nope. Ah, that's good enough. I don't know how I did it, but okay. All right, so now my cursor won't disappear. Okay, chemical composition of the body. Good enough. Here are some things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about some atoms. All right, so when you have a sort of a complicated topic like chemistry or understanding physiology, it's best to start with little things. Break the body down into its smallest components and then study the small components and then add things together, right? We call that integration. Add your knowledge together and then all of a sudden you start to appreciate how your body is working. Like your finances at home are probably pretty complicated. There's no way to understand your finances unless you break them down. What can you break your finances down into? Well, how much do you need for car payments? How much do you need for auto insurance? How much do you need for your water bill, electric bill, right? Car payments, housing, right? So then you've broken down your finances and you can really analyze what to do, right? And then that's got to balance with your income. All right, so we're going to start to analyze the human body, starting with chemistry because it's the smallest pieces of this class. Okay, so we're going to talk about atoms and then some chemical bonds, and then we're going to talk about the pH scale, and then we're going to look at some organic molecules, four classes of organic molecules that we find in your body and what their jobs are inside the body. Okay. All right, so atoms. This is the smallest part of matter. These are the smallest chemical elements. And we're going to use a model to think about an atom that is fairly realistic. Okay, it's not exactly what's happening inside an atom, but it's pretty close. It's called the solar system model. So the solar system model means like just in our solar system, in the very center of our solar system, we have the sun. But in terms of our thinking, we're going to call this the nucleus of this particular atom. All right, so a nucleus can have different meanings, just like in anatomy. You probably realize that there is a nucleus of a cell, but there's also a nucleus in your brain that's a group of nerve cell bodies that are grouped together in your brain. It forms gray matter. That's a nucleus. Well, here's another meaning for nucleus. It's the center part of an atom that has certain subatomic particles that live in this nucleus right here. And you can have protons and neutrons. They reside in the nucleus. You never find them outside the nucleus. Orbiting the nucleus like we do planets. Okay, that's another subatomic particle, and that's called an electron. So in the nucleus, we have protons and neutrons, and in orbitals that surround the nucleus, we have electrons. Okay, so we got three subatomic particles to look at. Electrons that we find in orbitals right here have a nice negative charge. One negative charge. Absolutely going to be, we're going to call it one. And protons that are inside the nucleus right here have an opposite charge, but the exact same magnitude. It's going to be a positive one. So if we add an electron and a proton together, what do we get? What's the electrical charge? If they're exactly equal but opposite, then it's zero, right? And we say that that is neutral. And that's a really nice stable state because opposite charges do attract each other in terms of electrical charges, right? So protons do like to attract the electrons, and that forms an electrical charge of zero, and that's a nice neutral stable state. Okay, but the way that atoms are formed is that we have protons and neutrons in the nucleus and electrons in orbitals. Let's talk about some of these orbitals. They have a special arrangement associated with them. Okay? There are inner orbitals and then outer orbitals, and they're filled with some specific rules. We're not going to get too complex. We're just going to learn basically two rules. But the first orbital around a nucleus can hold up to as many as two electrons. Okay? Only two. And then if this atom wants to add more electrons to it, that next electron or the third electron can't go into the first orbital, it's got to go into the second orbital. Now here's the other rule that you have to know. Every orbital, okay, from two on out can accept more than two electrons. It can accept six. Okay, can accept six. And so in this first orbital is two, and the most in this second orbital down over here would be six, and we see, oh, but this one right here only has for electrons in the second orbital. Okay, that's going to be important in just a little bit. So here we have an atom, and I know what the name of this atom is. Okay, it's called a hydrogen, because the number of protons that are inside the nucleus will determine what kind of element it is. And when an element has one proton inside the nucleus, all right, we call that a hydrogen atom. And we see that it is, all right, a proton is what, a light blue color? Is that light blue? What color is that? Light blue, really good. Okay, so protons are going to be light blue. And dark blue is going to be a neutron. Is that dark blue? Purple. Ah, well, that's really close, really close. So here, all right, I see one proton inside the nucleus, and over here I see a number of protons, but I also see some neutrons in here as well. We're not going to be too concerned with neutrons in this class because clinically they're not too important except for when we talk about isotopes. But sometimes neutrons are placed inside the nucleus right here by nature, because what can you tell me about these two protons? Do they attract each other? Or do they repulse each other? Yeah, they repulse each other. So neutrons are placed into the nucleus so the nucleus doesn't just fly apart, right? So as we put all these protons inside the nucleus, it's going to want to fly apart, but neutrons are put in there so that things don't just degenerate, okay, fly apart. Okay, so I count 6 protons. So in order for this to be a neutral atom right here, if it has 6 protons in the nucleus, how many electrons should be in orbitals around it? It should have 6, and then it has no net electrical charge. Okay, now the reason why we're talking about this is because life forms, cells, are very electrical in their basic nature. Okay, and we want to know where that electricity comes from. And it comes from compounds that have electrical charges on them. We're going to see how that develops in just a second. And that's because these subatomic particles have electrical charge, and that can be manifest sometimes. All right, so we got 6 electrons. How do these 6 electrons fill up the orbitals of this carbon atom? We've put the first 2 in the first orbital, and we got to fill the inner orbitals first before we put electrons into outer orbitals. So we put 2 electrons in the first orbital, right? And we said we started with 6, so how many are left to put into the next orbital? There's 4, right? So then we got 4, and the overall charge of this atom now is neutral, right? Which is a pretty good thing. Okay. Now, I think the next slide shows that the atomic mass, that's something that you should remember, right? Actually, let's focus on atomic number. The atomic number is the number of protons that you find inside the nucleus of an atom. And the atomic number for carbon is 6 by definition. Everybody agrees that carbon has 6 protons inside the nucleus. And how many protons does hydrogen have? It has 1. All right, so now let's look at the other slide over here. This thing is called a periodic table. I have it for you in Blackboard. You will have to use some knowledge of the periodic table to answer some questions on the test. So let's review some things about the periodic table. But you don't have to memorize it, because I'm going to give it to you, or I'll project it on the screen for the first test. So you don't have to memorize it, but you do have to know certain things. Okay, one thing that you have to know, the names of certain elements. So here is H. That stands for hydrogen. That's easy to know. All right, so these are just chemical abbreviations, because we don't always want to spell out hydrogen. We just want to draw H, right, so that we know. Another one that you have to know here is carbon. And guess what the symbol for carbon is? That's easy, all right? But it doesn't always stay that easy. For instance, if we go, here's another real important element, and that is Na. And Na really stands for natrium, okay? But in English, that is sodium, okay? All right, so I have a nice list. I have a table of elements. There's maybe about 10 or 15 elements that I do want you to know their English names for, as well as the chemical abbreviation for them. And K right here stands for potassium, because really it's kalium. That's the real name for it. You don't have to know the real names. You just have to know their chemical symbols. All right. Now here is another clue. All right. The atomic number, right above this H, I see a number 1. That tells me the number of protons that are inside the nucleus, which is what? The atomic number. And by definition, hydrogen atoms have 1 proton inside the nucleus. And it tells you right here. All right, so I could go down to sodium, which is Na, and I could ask you, how many protons are in the nucleus of sodium? And it says right here, the atomic number is 11. See how easy that is? Or we could go over here, and O stands for oxygen. How many protons are in the nucleus of an oxygen atom? There are 8, right? So you don't have to memorize that, but you do have to know how to use this periodic table. The other thing that's pretty cool about this periodic table is that if we look by the rows over here, here's a row, here's another row, this first row represents that first orbital. How many electrons do we put in that first orbital? 2. And here we see 2 elements, right? So that corresponds to the first orbital. How many can fill up that second orbital? Okay, there are 8. And guess what we have here? 8. So you don't have to memorize that. All you have to do is look at the periodic table to see that. All right, so it's pretty cool the way the periodic table is developed. Maybe some other compounds that you have to know, Fe. What the heck is Fe? Iron. Right, so you guys are pretty good, but don't be tricked because iron is not I. Iron is actually iodine. Okay, so there are some twists and turns that you do have to pay attention to. All right, so that's the importance of the periodic table. Atomic number is what I want you to know because when you change the atomic number, what do you change? You change what element that you're talking about, okay? All right, so you have to know that. So you'll have this periodic table handy for you. Okay, what do we have right here? Okay, I think maybe we talked about these things. Electrons fill up shells or orbitals. These are layers around the nucleus. Do you ever find an electron inside the nucleus of an atom? For this class, you're going to say no, never, never, never. And where do you find protons? Only inside the nucleus, never flying around in orbitals, right? The first shell has 2 electrons, second shell has 8 electrons, and then we fill up subsequent shells with 8 electrons. And you don't have to worry about this energy statement right here. That's probably not so important. Okay, valence electrons. This is pretty important. We're going to use this term valence. Are electrons in the outermost shell? And it's only the electrons that are in the outermost shell that can participate in chemical reactions. And that's how we maintain life. We're running all kinds of chemical reactions in our body. That's how our body stays alive, right? By the interaction of different atoms, but in particular the valence electrons, because it can form or break bonds. Okay, that's where chemistry comes from. All right, so let me go back let me see what the next slide is like. What's the next slide? Nope, let me go back a couple. All right, so here is the inner shell, which contains only 2 electrons. Are these valence electrons? They're not. Valence electrons are in the outermost shell. How many valence electrons does this carbon atom have? It's got 4, right? So that's how we're going to use that term, valence. All right, so now let's proceed to the next one. All right, different forms of the same atom, okay, can be an isotope, right? If they're the same atom, they're going to have the same number of protons inside the nucleus, all right, but they can have a different number of neutrons, and it's not going to change the element. It's going to change the atomic mass of that nucleus. It's going to change the stability of the nucleus, okay? And sometimes isotopes are used in medicine, because those nuclei are unstable, they'll kick out particles, and those particles are high energy, and they can be damaging. So, for instance, if somebody has a tumor, they can take a radioactive isotope and focus that energy on the tumor, and since it's a high energy radiation, it's going to kill the tumor. Right? These isotopes can also be used for imaging studies, because they'll leave your body and hit a film and make a mark on the film, and we can tell maybe what part of the body is healthy or diseased as a result of that. Okay, so isotopes are used in medicine, but that's a kind of chemistry that we don't spend much time on in this particular class. Just remember that an isotope is the same element, so it has the same number of protons, just a different number of neutrons. You might be interested in that sometime, but probably not so much in this class. Here is the table, the list of elements that you have to know because these are found in the human body. So you got to know the chemical symbol. So Ca stands for calcium. That's easy. We're going to use that one a lot. Magnesium is important. All right, here it is. That's Mg. So what you have to know for the test are these first 2 columns. This third column over here is kind of fun to look at, but you don't have to memorize that. It just tells us what the percentage is of this atom in your body. So I see oxygen, 65% by weight. Okay, then hydrogen is almost next, but hydrogen is a really small molecule. It doesn't weigh very much, so it doesn't contribute much to the weight. But in most cases, for every oxygen, you have two hydrogens. Why is that? What do you call H2 and O? Everybody knows that before taking this class. That's water, right? And we're mostly made out of water, and that kind of shows it in this table right here. So it's kind of fun to look at this table right here. But what you have to know is that manganese is Mn, but Mg is magnesium, right? Pronounced a little bit differently. Sulfur is S, that's easy. Do we have another S? We don't have another S. Okay, but iron and iodine, and don't mix up fluorine with iron, which is Fe. Okay, so it's not really complicated, but you got to study it a little bit. All right, so I'm not going to spend any more time on that because we want to get to the fun stuff, which is chemical bonds. So chemical bonds have to do with electrons within an atom. And in particular, what kind of electrons? The valence electrons, and where do you find those? Outermost shell. Okay, the number of bonds is determined by the number of electrons needed to complete the outermost shell. Excuse me. Okay, so atoms are very stable when the outermost shell, or this valence shell, is completely filled up with electrons. And so here we have an atom. And so in order for this atom to be stable, how many electrons should be in the outermost shell right here? There should be two. Okay. We're going to talk about one kind of bond. It's called a covalent bond. And we're going to learn four different kinds of bonds and their relative strength. And it's going to be important in physiology. Okay. Covalent bonds are the strongest bonds. They're difficult to break. All right. There's a lot of energy associated with a covalent bond. But if you do break them, it releases a lot of energy. And biological systems sometimes can tap into that energy and run your body. Okay, what's the energy molecule in your body, right? It's not important for this particular slide, but it's so important for you to appreciate. What is the energy molecule in your body? ATP, adenosine triphosphate, right? So we're going to pay attention to that throughout the whole class. All right, so let's get back to this example right here. Here we have an atom, and it has one proton inside the nucleus. What's the name of this element right here?
Hydrogen.
It's hydrogen, right? It says so right here on the periodic table. All right, and in order for hydrogen to be stable, there should be two electrons in its outermost shell. But, okay, how many electrons are around this hydrogen atom right here? There's only one, right, because there's one proton inside the nucleus. But it's looking for another electron. All right, so it can bump into another hydrogen atom, and it can form a nice symbiosis right here because the second hydrogen atom is looking for an electron as well. So if they bump into each other just the right way, these two atoms can share these two electrons. And sometimes both will be up over here, sometimes they'll be both of them up over here. But nonetheless, both of these nuclei now feel like they have two electrons around them, and this orbital is filled up, and it becomes nice and stable, and it forms a molecule when that happens. So a molecule is when two or more atoms join together to form a chemical bond between them. All right, so now we have how many plus charges in this molecule? How many plus charges are there? There are two because it has two protons. And then how many negative charges are there? There are two. So 2 minus 2 is zero. It's a nice stable molecule. All right, and these two atoms are joined together by a covalent bond. And a covalent bond is described by these electrons as being shared. So anytime you see that term shared electrons, you want to say what kind of bond? A covalent bond, right? Sharing of electrons produces a covalent bond, which is relatively strong, okay? And these electrons are found anywhere in this neighborhood right here, so we say that it is a nonpolar covalent bond because these electrons can be found anywhere. So this hydrogen molecule is nonpolar. I'm going to have to describe polarity for you guys in just a second. Okay. All right, so let's talk about some polar bonds. Here we have H, two H's and an oxygen. That is what we know to be water, right? H2O, that's water. And this oxygen right here, let's actually make a water molecule. Oh, I didn't check to see if I had any markers. Okay. You got a good one? Fantastic. Okay, so let's make a water molecule using orbital theory that we learned. Let's start with oxygen. All right, so here is oxygen, and inside, oh, that's nice and dark, thank you. So here is an oxygen. How many protons are inside the nucleus of oxygen? Ah, what do you got to do? Look at the periodic table. Is that over here? And you're going to see it has 8, right? So it's got 8 protons inside the nucleus. All right, so how many electrons does oxygen have? It's got 8. All right, so let's fill up some of these orbitals. The first orbital has got 2 electrons. Can I put another one in here? No, it's forbidden. Never happens. Okay. All right, so here is the next orbital. What would we call this orbital right here? That's the valence orbital, right? That's the outermost. And how many electrons can we put in this orbital right here? We can put 6. All right, so let's put 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, and then 5, and then 6. Right? Was that too fast? Is it like a card trick? No, I hope not. Okay, that was pretty fast, but hopefully slow enough. So how many electrons? 8. How many protons? 8. What's the overall charge on this atom right here? It's neutral, right? Okay. But this oxygen is not happy, even though it's neutral. What's it missing? 2 electrons right here and right here. And so it's searching the whole universe for a couple of electrons, and it bumps into a hydrogen atom. And what does that hydrogen atom have that is it willing to give to the oxygen, or is it willing to share? It's willing to share with this oxygen. So here is a hydrogen atom. How many protons inside? It's got 1 and 1 electron. All right, so here's the orbital for that hydrogen, and there's an electron. So here it's going to share that electron. So now this hydrogen atom over here feels like it has 2. This oxygen feels like it has another one. And so now this thing is going to be running around over the whole universe looking for another electron to come in here, and it bumps into another hydrogen atom, right, that has an electron right here that is willing to do what with? Share. Okay? And so now there are 2 electrons on this hydrogen atom. And what about the valence orbital on this oxygen atom? It's completely filled up, right? It's got 8. So now this is a nice stable molecule. Okay. Now here is just one little complicating fact. There's no charge on this molecule, if the water molecule, if we're sitting in the back row. Okay. But if we walk up on this molecule and kind of sneak up on it from this direction over here, it looks like it's going to have a positive charge. Because what are you going to run into first? This hydrogen, this proton first, right? If we sneak up on the water molecule from this direction, guess what? It doesn't look neutral. It looks like what? A little negative because of all of these electrons around it. And from this end over here, again, it looks kind of positive. It's not a full charge like a proton or an electron. It's just a tiny little positive or negative charge. So sometimes we symbolize that with this symbol. So here is a little negative charge here. And then down over here is a little positive charge. And over here is a positive charge. All right. And if we add these 2 little positive charges with this negative charge, what happens? They cancel out, right? So this little partial charge is exactly half of this one right here. Just because of the way the oxygen nucleus sucks in all these electrons around it. It doesn't like to share. It's unequal sharing of electrons. So therefore, all right, we call that a polar compound or polar covalent bonds. Because the ends of that molecule are a little bit different. All right, there are some other atoms that do that as well. Not only oxygen, and that's on your slide right here, nitrogen can produce polar covalent bonds when it is covalently bound to hydrogen. That's actually a condition. It's got to be covalently bound to a hydrogen. Nitrogen, phosphorus, oh, and then one more. And that is S, which is what? Sulfur. Okay? So oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, or O, N, P, and S form these strange kind of covalent bonds that are polar, and it changes their chemistry completely in terms of how it's going to work inside the body. Okay, but nonetheless, this is a covalent bond. Why? Why is this a nice covalent bond? Because these electrons are being shared. Okay, and in particular, it's a polar covalent bond because this is an oxygen atom right there. Okay, so don't forget the other three kinds of atoms that produce polar covalent bonds. Okay, well, this is one thing that you might recognize about this class, is that sometimes it takes me two or three lectures to complete a thought. Okay, so we're just learning some little pieces, and then after two lectures, right, go back and look at your notes and things like that, and you'll have a really nice complete picture of what's going on. So I just got to give you some little pieces. All right, so let's continue talking about some of these little pieces. The next kind of bond is called an ionic bond. It is weaker than a covalent bond, okay? And it's going to produce something called ions. Ions have charge associated with them, and that's one of the reasons why our bodies are very electrical, why our nervous system runs on electricity, because we have molecules that have electrical charges on them. All right, so this occurs, ionic bonds occur when valence electrons, which electrons are those again? Outermost shell, are transferred from one atom to another. They're not shared, but they're transferred. So transferred is the key term. Covalent is shared, ionic is transferred, forming charged ions. All right, so I'm going to leave that slide on the board, and maybe just for fun, we can build some more molecules here and talk about ionic bonds. All right, so we got something that has 11 P's in the nucleus. What the heck is that? That's a sodium, right? According to the periodic table, it's right up over there. And then we got something that has 17 protons inside the nucleus. What's that? And that's one of the elements you got to know, but that's over here someplace. That's a chlorine atom. All right, so let's draw those out. So we have something with 11 in the nucleus right here. So how many electrons does this guy have? 11. So the first shell has 2. Who cares where they are? They're just in there. So how many are left over? So we got 9 left. Here's the next orbital. How many do we put in here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Could I put a ninth one in there? No, only 8. 8 is maximum. So that means we got an extra electron left over someplace. Where does that have to go? Can we put it in here? No, we can't, right? So here is the next orbital, and we've got one electron. Now, how does the sodium feel? Really strange, because it likes to have 8 electrons in this orbital, but it would be satisfied with 0, because then the next shell right here would be completely filled up with 8, and it would feel really good. All right, so what does it want to do with this electron? Get rid of it. All right, so that it's nice and stable. So it just so happens that here is another atom with, what, 17 protons inside the nucleus. So that means it has 17 electrons. First orbital has got 2. Next orbital has got 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, 9, 10. But we got 7 left, right? We got 7 left. And where do those have to go? And the outermost shell. So we've got, how many did we say is left? 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So this guy is what? Looking to get rid of these 7 electrons? A lot simpler just to get one from someplace. Okay? All right. So don't forget, this is sodium here. Here is chloride right there. So this sodium is really happy to get rid of this electron, donate it to the chlorine atom. All right, but now this sodium right here, what's the overall charge with sodium if we get rid of this electron? It's positive, right? And now what about the chlorine? It's negative, and they're both exactly 1. What can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. So these two atoms form a nice molecule based on that electrical attraction, right, that you now understand through this orbital theory right here. But what kind of bond is it compared to a covalent bond, strong or weak? It's weak. It's a relatively weak bond because you know when you take sodium chloride, which is table salt, which is in your salt shaker, and put it in a glass of water, what happens to it? Okay, it breaks apart. So sodium chloride crystals will break apart. We call that ionization, okay, or dissociation. And sodium and chloride will dissolve in water. Okay. But before we get to the next slide, here we have, so let's put this in water and these atoms break apart. It has the number of electrons and protons don't exactly match each other, so these develop charges associated with them. So these are ions because they have an electrical charge that produces electricity in our body, okay? And they're ions. Sometimes they're called electrolytes. Electrolyte, L-Y-T-E, not L-I-G-H-T. So sometimes, and that's very important, electrolytes, because they're involved with producing electricity inside our bodies. You might be in an emergency room sometime and somebody yells out, "We need some lights on this patient right away." So what are you going to do? Go find a flashlight and turn the lights on in the room and shine a lot of lights on them? Or what should you do? Grab that vial with blood, take it down to the lab so the lab can analyze the number of electrolytes that are in the blood, like sodium and like what? Chloride and magnesium and potassium, because they're responsible for maintaining homeostasis in your body, the electrical homeostasis, right? So these are electrolytes. Furthermore, this electrolyte is different than this one because it has opposite charges, and we need a terminology to talk about this. If an electrolyte has a positive charge, we call it a cation. If it has a negative charge, we call it an anion. All right, so I had an organic chemistry teacher draw this on the board, and it's haunted me my whole life, so I'm going to do the same for you. Okay, a nice little nose right here, here, mouth, and guess what we got to do with these eyeballs right here? Okay, so remember, cation has positive charges. Anions have negative charges. All right, so I know you all can read these slides, and that's what it says right here, but that graphic will probably haunt you the rest of your life, too. Okay. All right, so why does sodium and chloride dissolve in water? What kind of molecule is water? Let's go back. Can you remember? Okay, it has polar covalent bonds, which means that the oxygen end of the molecule is a little bit negative and the hydrogen end of a water molecule is a little bit positive, so that when you have a sodium ion, which is a cation, it likes to associate with the oxygen in water. And so when you put an ion in water, it dissolves in water because it can form hydration spheres around the ion. Right, and what can you tell me about the negative charge on this water right here and the positive charge on sodium? Opposite charges attract, okay? Now, what about an anion? Can an anion dissolve in water? Yeah, because the opposite end of water is positive charge, right? And that's going to be associated with the negative charge of this chlorine right here. So chlorine dissolves in water as well. So that's the reason why a sodium chloride crystal will break apart, will dissociate when you put it in water, because these opposite electrical charges are very happy to neutralize each other in solution. If you have a molecule with nonpolar bonds, with no electrical properties associated at all with it at all, it won't dissolve in water, right? Because water is polar, and if we put a nonpolar substance in water, it won't dissolve. And you probably are familiar with some nonpolar compounds that you can't get out of your clothes if you were just to put it in water. Like what? Like oil, fats, lipids, and things like that. And so there are like two major worlds that makes up our planet. There are polar compounds and there are nonpolar compounds. And these two worlds don't like to mix up with each other. They separate from each other. Okay, so that's going to be a real important concept throughout the whole class. All right, before I let you go, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. And we're good. So we're going to start next time just talking about finishing up that concept of polarity by talking about hydrophobic and hydrophilic compounds. Okay, and no one has said they don't want the lectures online, so I'll get that site up and going with the lecture recordings over the weekend.